The following is an edited podcast of a conversation with playwright Vern Thiessen, playwright members of Pat the Dog, and artistic director Lisa O'Connell. The conversation occurred on January 27th, 2012, at the Seven Shores Urban Cafe in Waterloo, Ontario. Our conversation begins with Vern Thiessen, who is asked, "What did you do before you became a playwright?"
I was working in IT in Toronto. No, I'm joking. You know, my path to being a playwright is a long one, and I wrote my first play when I was in grade six, but I didn't remember that until a lot later in life, and I kind of always kind of noodled around with writing plays, and then in the late 80s, I started to write stuff for myself as an actor, and then I wrote a couple of short plays, and then I had my first full-length production when I was 26 at the National Arts Center. But at that point in time, I was still like, yeah, I'm not a playwright, I'm a guy who writes plays occasionally. And it wasn't until really the year 2000, it took a long time for me to kind of go, okay, now I'm actually going to commit to being a playwright as my profession. So, you know, it's been 13, 14, 12, I can't add. It's been 12 years since I made that kind of commitment to do that. And it took a long time to build up the work and to build up a body of work that I feel very proud of and that can stand. But it took a long time for me to get there. Does that answer your question? You can please, it's a conversation, so.
You were acting?
Like, oh, I see. Yeah. So I was doing a bunch of things. I was acting for a while, and I stopped doing that, and then I was teaching, and I still teach. I still do a lot of teaching. I enjoy teaching. I was teaching acting and theater and all kinds of things. Then what did I do? I ran the drama department at a small college for a little while, and then I... hi, come on in.
Welcome.
It's all right. And then I worked for the government of Alberta for 3 years, and then I worked as the literary manager for a theater for a long time. You know, but I've also had lots of other jobs. I worked in a candy factory for a while. I worked at Rogers Video, you know.
A bicycle messenger.
I was. Yeah, I was a messenger in Toronto in the law firms. You know, I've had a lot of day gigs in my life, and I still continue to have them. They're mainly in teaching theater now, but for a long time they weren't anything that I could make some money at doing. So there was a big switch that happened in my life. I was working for the government. I was in my mid-30s, and something happened. It's a terribly dramatic story, where I was in the apartment in the elevator of this apartment building in my condominium, and a guy had a heart attack in the elevator, and I thought he had died. Later on, I found out that he had lived, but I thought that he had died. And so I didn't know anything about CPR or anything like that, but I did my best. And I was very shaken up by the experience, as was he. Mm-hmm. And but the next day I walked into the government and I thought, I was supposed to do this. I don't think I should be a literary arts consultant for the rest of my life. And so I quit my job the next day. I mean, I didn't. I gave my notice the next day, I suppose. I wasn't foolish. It took a long time to freelance, and I was a speech writer. I mean, I did all kinds of anything that I could find just to get started as a playwright, to really take my work seriously.
Now, that life-changing event, was that in 2000?
Yeah.
Okay.
How did you know it was playwriting and not another form of writing? Because you've written lots of different forms, right?
Yeah, I'm a closet poet. But I don't show that stuff around very much. It kind of seeps into my plays occasionally. I don't write fiction at all. I'm terrible at writing fiction. I've done some screenwriting, but no, I think playwriting was the thing in my life that never really ever bored me. And so I was never bored doing it. I got bored as an actor. I got bored as a director, directed a lot of plays. I've gotten bored teaching, but I never really gotten bored when it comes to writing.
Why don't you get bored with playwriting?
I have no idea. Only God, the gods know that. I get tired writing plays sometimes.
Does it piss you off? Sometimes?
Do
you find it frustrating sometimes, playwriting?
No, I find it a challenge. It's not always enjoyable, yeah. Especially when you're exhausted or you're, you know, the reviews come out and you think I'm going to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge now or, you know, yeah, sometimes it's a big challenge and stuff like that. But yeah.
Can I ask you to come? Lisa was talking about, you know, frustrating it is to write sometimes. And I wonder if you can comment on one of your more frustrating processes and how you rised up through it, how you created your process or developed it or whatever to get through the more frustrating project you had.
Well, I think the frustrations have changed over the years and they've gone through different cycles. And, you know, let me categorize them for you in very, very briefly.
Yeah.
Hi there. Come on in.
Come on in. Welcome.
Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah.
So what are they? Well, when you're a younger playwright or a less experienced playwright, let's put it that way, you know, the biggest frustration is getting anybody to take you seriously, right? And is to get produced. Even if you're self-producing, it's an enormous amount of work, right? To self-produce and to put up your own play, let alone try to convince somebody else to do your play.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you get past that hurdle, then it's like a huge difficulty getting anybody else to do a second production of your play, let alone a third or fourth or a fifth or 10th or 20th production.
Yeah.
So those frustrations of realizing that writing a good play is just the beginning of the process of being a playwright, that you are actually like no other person in the theater, a business person. Because unlike anybody else, you get paid on the back end, mm-hmm. right? It's the only job in the theater where you are in a partnership with the theater company. So how they market your play will determine how much you get paid. And so when you get beyond just like, geez, I just want to write a good play, that's one level of frustration.
Yeah.
Then you go to the frustrations never end. So then you go to the next level of frustration, which is, wow, how can I make a living doing this, right?
Yeah.
Which is a huge, huge thing. It's very difficult to do. But I can tell you right now, very possible from my experience. And then, you know, there's frustrations of audience and critical reaction to the work, you know, whether it's you know, people telling you that they love your work too much or hate the work, or the critics don't like you, or, you know, dealing with criticism on any level, whether it's a dramaturgical meeting or whether it's some bozo from the local paper who doesn't understand anything about what you're trying to do. So there's that kind of level of frustration. And then, you know, there's the continued level of frustration you know, working in forms that might be a little out of your purview. And so you have to, like, learn how to get over the hurdles of writing a better play. Like, you have to be able to push yourself or find people to surround yourself with people who will push you to write a better play. So, like, pick one of them, and I can give you an hour-long, you know, conversation on each one of them. Yeah. So which of those is of great interest to you? Is it about the process of writing?
Yeah, mostly, like, the process of writing, maybe the last thing you said, you, like...
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's an experience that I had, mm-hmm. for example. I'll use my experience of Einstein's Gift, which I won the Governor General's Award in 2003. So... it's one of the very few plays that I've ever written on speculation, which means that I wasn't commissioned to write it. I wrote it because I thought it might be an interesting play to write. Mm-hmm. It took me 7 years to write that play. Nobody wanted to do it. And I started off with a three-act play that was 150 pages long and had 27 characters in it. And eventually it went down to a two-act play that had 12 actors, or 7 actors playing 12 roles. And the process of that was really like, you know, I went up against this, you know, wall of the theaters going, we will never, ever do this play. But the key thing was, like, this guy, Bob Baker, is the artistic director of the Citadel Theater in Edmonton, who's been a real stalwart for me. And he's the one who kept on saying, yeah, I think it could be better. Mm-hmm. I think you can write a better play than this, can't you? and sent me back and sent me back and sent me back and sent me back to write a better and better play, where I think a lot of people would have given up.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always encouraging, but I had to learn the discipline of going back, and I had to learn the lesson that your job as a playwright is to ask the question, how can I make this a better play? And that question never, ever ends, ever.
Can I interject?
Yes.
So when is a play finished then?
It never is.
Ever.
It's only abandoned.
Even when it's published?
So there you go, Einstein's Gift. I changed the second publication.
Mm-hmm.
I completely changed a whole section of the play. Shakespeare's Will, which was just done at Stratford last year, between the very first publication and the second publication is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can, if I have the opportunity, I will try to make the play better if I can. I can't do it all the time now because I just don't have time.
Yeah.
But we're going to possibly do a production of Apple, this play that I wrote 10 years ago in New York, which has been done around the world. And we did a reading of it in New York a little while ago, and I hadn't heard the play in a long time, like 5-6 years. And I listened to it, and I was like, yeah, that scene sucks. I think I need to change that scene. I've always hated that scene. I think if we do this again, I'm going to rewrite that scene. So, but to make that shift into, is the play ever done? No. Now, that's not the same as saying that you have to know when to stop writing.
Mm-hmm.
Or that you need to know when it's time to defend your material and go, no, this scene works, go make it work. But so it's a very fine art of realizing. But I'm talking about striving for greatness.
Yeah.
I'm talking about forcing yourself to write the best play that you can write, not what everybody else thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And that internal thing is really hard to. That's really hard, and that took me a long time to get there. To kind of go, oh right, I guess I should do better.
Yeah.
I guess I might be able to do better. I guess I should work harder. And so, because ultimately, this is the thing, you have to take responsibility for your work. You have to take responsibility for writing the best play that you can. You can't leave it to a dramaturg or a director or to actors in your play to make mm-hmm. your play any good. You have to make it the best thing that you can.
The next question comes from Lisa O'Connell, who asks about playwright scars, or criticism and unrealized expectations.
Well, that's true. I probably did say that, and it probably came from Bruce McManus, who's one of my many, many mentors that I've had, who, when I had a failure in Edmonton when I was a young playwright, and I had written a one act for the Fringe Festival, and it got completely murdered in the press, and I walked around the city thinking, like Marcel Proust or something, thinking that everybody... You see that guy? He just had a failure at the Fringe Festival. Right? So arrogant, right? And then I live in New York now, and then eventually I fast forward 20 years, and then you get, like in New York, when you have a show off Broadway, you get maybe 50 reviews, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Edmonton, you're lucky if you get two. So you get 50 reviews, and I had a huge bomb in New York in 2009 with a play of mine. And like every day, like I was getting scarred every single day. So eventually you just have to learn to laugh. But my friend Bruce McManus would say, you know, he just said, yeah, you know, there's nothing you can do. You just got to weep. You just got to go home and cry.
Yeah.
and it's true. You just kind of go, you know, it's every time a show opens and it goes out into the world, it's a bit of a loss because you've lost control over it. You have to give it over to the actors and the director, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that process gets easier as you get older, right, and more experienced.
I know I keep holding the floor with my questions and everybody else probably.
That's all right. We got time.
But so
what we don't have is booze, but we have time.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Okay, so when it's play finished is one thing. When is it ready for you to give it to a producer or to a dramaturg or a director and say,
yeah,
here you go, I got something?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I don't have a really good answer for that. It's instinct. All I can tell you is that almost 99% of the time, you're giving your play to somebody too early.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm totally guilty of it. It's that you should sit on your play for as long as possible because chances are you're showing it to somebody too early. In some cases, I've received scripts from people. There's a young writer out of Calgary who sent me a script recently that I was working online with him, and that play was almost finished from his first draft. Like, it was so good. I read it and was like, wow. But he had been working on it for like 3 years and hadn't shown it to anybody. Mm-hmm. That takes a certain amount of guts. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the answer is. But what I would recommend, what I always recommend is, if you think you're finished something, you know, show it to somebody who you trust, and don't show it to 15 million people, right? Show it to like one person, mm-hmm. and then see how that feels, and see where you can go from there, and feel it out. When I was younger, I would like distribute my play at, I would give everybody a copy of my play. They didn't even need to know me.
Yeah.
You know, hey, do you want to read my play? But now I'm much more picky about who I give the work to and at what stage. And so, err on the side of caution, I would say. Plays are really, especially plays in the early days, are really easy to destroy. You know, the heart of a play, that kind of feel that only comes in a first draft, mm-hmm. is really, it's that easy thing to kill. And so you want to make sure that you don't give it to somebody who's going to kill it right away by going, I don't think so. Or, it was all right, I guess. But, you want somebody who's going to be able to talk to you about what's great in the play and what part of the flower needs to grow. You can deal with trimming the weeds later.
Right.
Yeah?
Cool.
You mentioned that it was hard to get a second production, and you've been produced pretty internationally, well beyond just the U.S. and Canada. You've been produced in Europe. How much of it is marketing? How much of it is branding? How much of it is dumb luck?
It's all of those things. Mm-hmm. I made a real pact with myself, and I'm perhaps unusual in this regard, that even early on, I decided that I was going to spend a great deal of time marketing my plays. And that I wanted to make a living doing it. And the only way that you can make a living doing it is if you have production outside of Canada. And that has nothing to do with our beautiful, wonderful country. It has to do with the fact that there's just not enough theaters in this country to support all the playwrights that live in this country. So you've got to go. Eventually, you will outgrow your culture, as John Morrell told me once. And you've got to go to, in my case, into Europe, into Australia, into Asia. I still haven't gotten into South America, but I'm hoping. Into the United States, of course, it's a big market. Britain is really hard to crack. I've never had a production in Britain. That's not true. Shakespeare's Will was done there last year, but it was done in Wales. So I'm joking to the Welsh. No, but I mean, as a Canadian, getting a production in London is very, very tricky. So, a lot of it's dumb luck. It's a lot of people like just passing scripts on to other people who pass them on to other people, and it's, like a disease, it gets out there. Some of it is just direct marketing to places. Some of it's through publications. The Governor General's Award is a huge calling card overseas, much more than it is here in Canada. Mm-hmm. I have more productions of Lennon's and Balmer's than I'll ever get in Canada. Nobody cares. But a lot of that was me, and a lot of that was muscling my way into theater companies, and frankly, lying. I spent a lot of time lying to theater companies early on, because it was impossible to get productions. Right? They wouldn't even read the play. Do you know Noam Chomsky and his film Manufacturing Consent, or his book Manufacturing Consent? So I would manufacture consent. I don't really do it anymore, because I have three wonderful agents around the world who really promote my work for me, who lie for me. But it's a little easier now than it used to be, just because the snowball starts to roll down the hill. But in the early days, it was really hard. So I would phone up Theater X and I would say, you know, Theater Y is really interested in this play, and I think they want a co-production with you of this play. And then I'd phone they had no interest in it. And then I would phone the other theater and go, yeah, you know what, these guys, they're really interested in the play, and I think they might want a co-production. You should really call them. And I would phone everybody and tell them that everybody else was doing the play, and that if they really wanted the rights, they should get on it. And like it was out, and this is before I had an agent, this was out and out duplicity. But it was like, I was, you know, you get so frustrated with people, you know, particularly in the Canadian theater scene. It's much, much better elsewhere.
It's not lying, it's spreading the truth.
Yeah, it's spreading the truth. Thank you very much.
Literally all wanted to do it.
There you go. So I did a lot of that. And, you know, it took a little bit of chutzpah, or people, and, you know, people might say I'm an arrogant prick because of it, or I'm pushy or demanding. But, you know, even last year, I got on the horn, and I thought, well, why isn't this play of mine, Vimy? It's not getting more. I don't know why it's not getting more productions. This is crazy. It's gotten like a great review here, and it's been doing well there. So I just phoned up this theater company in Vancouver that had done a play of mine 10 years ago, and I said, why aren't you doing this play? I've sent it to you a million times. Have you read it? No. Well, you should, because at the National Arts Center, they did 98% box office. They made money on the play. And if you market it properly, you can do the same. And it fits your mandate. And you're crazy not to do this play. And they did it. That's a rarity, because most of the time they go,
yeah.
F you. And then hang up the phone and they go, who do you think you are? But, you know, you have to be, in this country, you have to have a mix of kind of aggression and, you know, that passive aggression, right? Where you have to kind of pretend that you're really humble that they're doing your play, when really you know in your heart that if they did the play, they would actually make some money. The best thing that you can do is convince them, not that you should do my play, but that this play serves your community. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to do that, you have to have a play that does serve their community. So you have to look at what is the play that I'm writing and who is it serving, right? And so if I'm writing a play, I'm just using Vimy as an example. There's a lot of communities that can go see that play, the Aboriginal community, the French community, the veterans community, and God knows we have enough young veterans in our country now again. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about old veterans necessarily. There are history people, you know, there's all kinds of people who are going to go see that play. So I convinced the Citadel to premiere that play, because I convinced them that I spoke passionately to them about the fact that I thought I would serve these communities. And so, and that wasn't a lie. You know, that was me going, who do I want to see my play? So it's not good enough to say, I'm a good playwright and this is a good play and you should do it. You have to figure out, how is it going to serve that company? And because the company is the conduit to the audience. And you don't want an empty theater watching your play. You want people watching your play. And you don't want a bunch of theater people watching your play. You want real people watching your play, right? So with Stephen, I talked to him about, who's your audience? What kind of farce should I be writing? How am I going to serve that audience in Collingwood, right? That doesn't mean I pander to them, although in this case it might be, I'm not sure. But am I pandering to your audience? So, but how are we going to serve them, and how are we going to serve the company? Does that answer your question? So it's very philosophical in nature, right? In terms of and then you figure out what are the ways to get to that place.
Okay. I hear a lot of things about what you should be worried about during self-production. What are the things you shouldn't be worried about as a playwright during self-production?
During self-production. So if you're putting something on at a festival or something like that.
What are the things that I shouldn't be concerned about?
What should you not be concerned about as a playwright? there is nothing that you should not be concerned about. I guess concern, worry, and control are three different things. And so I would say that, you know, in self-production, I think that you want to be, have a low-level worry about everything. For example, here in Kitchener-Waterloo, you know, I've come in with a draft, and I know that Act 4 sucks, and that Act 1 has got some problems. And so I sit down with the dramaturgical team and with the director, and I say, these are the things that I think we need to work on while we're here. What do you think? And they go, yes, no, maybe, what about this, what about that? And so we decide, we create a plan, right, together as to how to make the play better. Because that's all what it's all about, is making the play better. Is that fair?
That's totally right. It has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Vern's time that we're working on right now. My time's going to come later. And I've got ideas that are floating around, which may or may not work, but it'll depend on the words. The words and the music that are in the script that he's written. And it's up to me to take them from the page and to put them up on the stage. That's my job.
So I'm saying it as if this is like this, I've known this since I was born, right? But the fact is that it's come hard fought. I've you know, it's come through bitterness and tears and blood. And so, you know, I've learned the hard way a lot of times, and where, you know, and I've still learned where I haven't been prepared. I'm going through a process with a commission right now where I'm not on the same page as the commissioner. We're just not on the same page. And so I don't know. I'm not sure where to go with it. Do I take the project back? Do I just write what they want me to write and swallow it and ask for more money? Do I abandon the project after 3 years? I mean, it's very difficult. It's not like there's bumps along the road, even when you think you know what you're doing. So, but that's the general feel. Does that give you a kind of a path of thinking? You need to go, wow, I'll think about that and I'll get back to you. That's my standard phrase. If I don't think it's of my concern, I'll think about that and I'll get back to you.
This next question deals with creation and critique. The questioner wants to know, how do you know when your ego is getting in the way and when you are actually defending your work because it is worth defending?
Yeah, I don't know. That's that's an excellent question, and it that struggle never goes away. You know, I think when I was, I've gone through all kinds of different phases. One of them is, you know, changing too much of the text because people would tell me, you know, I don't see it. And I go, okay, I'll make it better. And then I went through a phase where it was like, no, it's all perfect. Nothing will change. And then you see the show and you go, oh my God, I should have rewritten that scene. And then, you know, and then there are some times where I've defended my work and I think I've been right to defend it. And then there are times where my ego got in the way, and there's no easy answer to that.
Awareness you've started to develop over the years where you kind of realize that that's...
This is my tool to dealing with that. This is my tool to dealing with that. Today was a good example. I got lots and lots of notes, and I requested them. It wasn't like, you know, the worst thing you could do is they read the play and then you just sit there. I mean, you could. I guess if you're Edward Albee, you do. But I'm just not that kind of guy. It's just not the way I work. I want the feedback. And so I asked a series of questions. I take responsibility for the feedback. And so the biggest thing for me, the easiest way to deal with it, is to write it down. Just take the feedback and write it down. Just take all the notes. Don't defend anything. Don't say anything. Just write it all down. And sometimes what you're doing is you're writing down, that's the worst note I've ever received. Oh, that's great. Okay. Yeah, that's great. That's the worst note I've ever... Who the hell does she think she is? But sometimes you're actually writing down, you know, exactly what they're saying. Because this is no response to any of the notes that I got today. you can look at my notes. Not one of them is not. So all the notes, I write them all down, and then I absorb them. And then the next day, or now the turnover is quicker for me, you know, I can look at them now pretty fast and go through them and go, yeah, I like that note. No, I don't like that note. Nah, not sure about that. Circle that, question mark. And then filter out, you know. The key thing is to feel, not to feel that you have to respond to everything or to anything. The only response that you have to do is to acknowledge that you've heard it. Just write it down. And then after that, all bets are off. That's the best way I found to deal with criticism.
I have a question from Twitter. Do you outline?
I'm so thrilled. This is my first question ever from Twitter. I should have let my people in New York know that this is going to be a podcast. Yeah, that's right. Yes, please. Thank you.
Yes. Do you outline? He's curious if writers outline and which don't.
Oh. Yeah, you know, when I first started writing, I didn't outline at all. I just wrote from my spirit and from my art, and I wrote from my instinct. And that was great, and I needed to do that. That was an important part of who I was as a writer at that time. I don't do that anymore. I don't have time. I don't have time to go through that with every play, because generally speaking, so right now I design a play. I outline in quite a lot of detail. Just makes things go faster. You're designing a play instead of, you know, you are a playwright, right? It's a W-R-I-G-H-T. So you are a builder of plays. You're not a scribe of plays. And so your job is to build a world. And so I do a lot of outlining now. I'm also working on 4 or 5 plays at the same time. And so in order to actually physically accomplish that, I need to outline. I don't have a specific methodology for outlining. I use my instinct for. But I do outline and keep notes. And then sometimes I abandon the outline and I go completely away from it. And sometimes I stick very close to it. But I generally outline now. Thank you, Twitter.
There was a podcast that you did about 5 years ago for ATP. And you said something along the lines of, and I hate parents.
Was it Theatre Alberta? I did one for Theatre Alberta. I don't think it was at ATP.
I'm trying to remember who you did it with.
Okay.
I don't know how many podcasts you do.
That's right.
But you said something along the lines of, male playwrights seem to get less ideas as they grow older.
Oh, yeah. That,
yeah.
Yeah, that was Theatre Alberta.
Yeah.
I did, you know. Keep on going.
Is
our gender doomed? I do believe, and you know, I was talking to Lisa about this earlier today, is that I'm just, you know, I'm getting ready to retire because I've written 10 full-length plays in the last 10 years, and I've written 8 short plays in the last 10 years. So I've written an enormous amount of work in the last 10 years, and it's exhausting. I'm pretty exhausted. And but hey, I got to write plays for a living for 10 years, so I'm thrilled by that. Better than, you know, again, working at McDonald's. I do believe, I don't know, it's a little pet theory. I kind of float it occasionally because I find that it gets great reaction. And so I'm not sure if I really believe it, but I do think that female playwrights, I'm basing this on nothing but my own instinct and observations. This is not a scientific study. I believe that female playwrights get better as they get older. And they produce more. Now, that there could be all kinds of reasons for that. I'm not talking about biologically. I'm talking about that they may finish raising their families. I'm talking about a certain generation now, like my generation, where, you know, after their childbearing years, quote unquote, that they will return to writing and actually produce much more mature, interesting work. Look, Judith Thompson's plays, like in the last 3 or 4 years, are unbelievably good. Palace of the End is an extraordinary play. And way better than some of the stuff that she wrote even 5 or 10 years ago. She knows that I feel this way, so I'm not saying anything that she would be appalled by. Sharon Pollock, you know, I think some of the plays that she wrote, she hasn't been very active lately because she is getting a little older now, but the plays that she wrote in her 50s that actually didn't get much play like Blue Trumpeter and things like that, they got maybe one or two productions, are way far superior to the plays that she wrote when she was younger. So I it's a little thing that I think that women actually get better as a playwright as they get older, and that men kind of burn out by the time they're 50. I know that I'm going to be turning 50 before I know it, and I'll be very happy to write one play every 5 years rather than write five plays in 1 year. So I would really like to start slowing down and spending more time on the work and writing, you know, my version of Peer Gynt. I think Stephen Theatre Calling would love that, wouldn't they? Peer Gynt. So yeah, that's I have no idea whether it's true or not. I'll throw it out.
This might be a hindsight question, but maybe it gives hope to us young emerging artists out there. I guess
there is no hope for you. Sorry, before you ask this question, I want to follow up on something like that. The other thing that I think, too, is that I've been thinking more and more is, like, it's time to get out of the way. You know, I remember when I was a young playwright, I was like, I looked at all these older playwrights in their 40s and 50s. I was like, get the fuck out of the way. It's my turn now, and it's time for my voice now. And now that I've matured and I've written all that stuff, I kind of think it's time for me to get out of the way. You know, I've had a lot of success and a lot of production, and there's a lot of younger voices that aren't being heard because I'm filling those slots. And it would be nice to step out of the way and let some people be heard where I've been forcing my way into those theaters for long enough. Yeah.
I guess as long as, like, a follow-up question in some sense, it's like, would you still have been working as hard as you have in a career in playwriting if you hadn't had outstanding success and if you didn't win a Governor General's Award and your play, like, you know, like if you were making enough to sort of make a living, but you didn't have this kind of notoriety that you kind of have now, or this kind of name, you know, are you still driven to keep creating? Because sometimes that set, you know, that kind of changes how you direct your path based on how much you make yourself worthy.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good question.
And that's
always
like the hindsight question.
That's, people always, when people say that's a very good question, it means I don't know the answer to that. but it's yeah, it is a hindsight question. And I guess the answer is no. I guess if I'd answered honestly, that what the Gigi gave me more than anything else was confidence. And and also a bit of revenge, you know, on the theater companies that, you know, passed it over. And so, it's the same thing with Lennon's and Balmer's, you know. That play got completely decimated in reviews in Toronto. It's not a surprise, but it was sure nice to get that Gigi nomination.
Vern Thiessen now answers the question, what is the best piece of dramaturgical advice he ever received?
If you haven't bored them to tears... That's a pretty good accomplishment. And, you know, that's my big advice is the biggest piece of dramaturgy I give myself with the other thing. I go, is it boring? Does it seem boring? I think it's boring. Can we put in something else that will make it not boring? So don't bore your audience. And keep your eye on the prize, which is really, there's an audience that's paying to see your work. And they're there for a reason, that they need something. What do they need? Now, what do they want? What do they need? That's the question that you're answering as an artist.
I have a good follow-up question to that. I think, you know, write the best play that you can write is really good advice. But is it boring is a really good question. Is there other questions that we should have in our minds as you read and revise that are like kind of like filters?
As you read and revise your own work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, rewriting is a skill that most playwriting instructors or schools or whatever I find do not teach. And asking yourself whether it can be better is a good thing. I have a couple of tricks. They're not even my tricks. I've just picked them up from other people over the years. There are certain things that you can do when you're rewriting your play Sorry, I'm, as you can tell, my brain is thinking, wine, a glass of wine, a glass of wine, a glass of red wine. You know, things like, I use tools like, you know, getting it out of a, getting into a scene late and getting out early. I don't know if you are familiar with that. But, you know, where are you entering the scene? Where are you exiting the scene is a big question. It all comes down to the, I use, it sounds so corny and hackneyed, but I use Aristotle's six elements of drama to analyze my own play. So I'll go, okay, let's start with setting. Are my stage directions on where this play takes place, of is it, are they interesting, right? Or are they prescriptive? Don't write those stage directions that go, he moves down left to the couch, right? That is of no help to anybody, except to the director who doesn't know what they're doing. So write a good stage direction. That all has to do with setting, rhythm, and song. We talked about music. But there's also the rhythm of the play. How do the scenes link together? How is the scene moving to the next? In this play that we're workshopping here, we've talked a little bit, not much, but a little bit about there's a lot of major scene changes, right? So how much of that do you put into the script in terms of what you want to see in a production? You know, dialogue. There is no play ever written that was too short, as far as I'm concerned. You know, brevity, brevity, brevity. What can I cut? What can I cut? What can I cut? What must I change? And what do I need to add? Those are three questions that I ask myself. What can I cut? What do I need to change? What must I add? Character is critical. Right now I'm dealing with a character issue in this play because the objectives, the tactics, the obstacles, and the stakes of the characters are not clear enough at the top of the play. I need to address that, which I'm going to do tomorrow afternoon. So that's something that I need to do. And plot is, of course, the great equalizer, because plotting is so hard. It's the hardest thing ever. Are the scenes in the right order? Is the play unfolding as it should? What if I take this section and move it up here? So looking at those six elements of drama, oh, and theme, you know, is the play saying what I want it to say? What is this play about anyway? Addressing all of those areas, those are all great rewrite tools that you can use as you go through your play. You shouldn't do them all at once because you'll fry your brain. But, you know, you pick one, and you pick another one, and you pick another one, and you just rewrite, and you rewrite, and you rewrite, and you rewrite, and no, it never ends. Ever. Yeah?
Thank you. Yes, very helpful.
So, it sounds like it's red wine time. So, I'm going to ask you if, what's the one thing that you wish you did? It's a stupid question, but if you were starting over now, what's the one thing you know now that you wish you knew then?
He paused, staring at the tray of vegetables in front of him, contemplating the question. I don't know.
What's the most important thing that you think that you need?
The important thing, what?
You start a play. What is it? You sit down, you have to write a play. What's the most important thing you have to have?
Well, you don't have to write a play. Nobody's forcing you to write a play.
You're commissioned. You're offered money. You have to write a play. You're coming into workshop. Get all these people waiting for you. They're paying dollars for you.
Right. What's the most important thing? Sorry, it's not that I don't have an answer, it's that I got a million answers. And so I'm trying to nail it down to one thing that I won't regret saying on a podcast, because apparently people listen to them 5 years later.
I was going to say.
So,
check us 5 years from now, Madison. Yeah, still
exactly. You're well over 50
you're
then.
Screwed now, teasing.
I guess the most, you know, the first thing is just like have fun, right? Like have fun. I mean, there's no point in being in this business if you're not having fun.
That's huge.
Yeah, and I, you know, so I haven't had a lot of fun lately. Today I have.
That's good.
I've been having fun on this project.
Two more days podcast, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, no, just that, you know, I'm working on so many things sometimes that I lose the fun. But I think my feeling is that, you know, in your guts, I think you want to know what the play's about or why the play is important. I'm answering your second question, not your first one, which is that you have to go, you have to walk into that room or start the play and kind of go, I think this play might be about this one thing. Instead of just kind of breezing off into something. And that all relates to why are you writing the play? Now, you know what? I'm going to go back and I'm going to say that the play is an expression of your individual voice and how you view the world. We could all be given the same commission and the same topic, and we would all come up with 15 different plays based on our individual voice. So it's really important that you write the truth the way you see it. That doesn't mean it has to be serious, right? Mm-hmm. But you have to write the truth the way that you see it. And what do I wish I knew back then? Well, you know, I wish I knew how to write a better grant application. That would have been helpful. I guess I don't wish this because it takes a long time to discover your own voice. It takes, like an opera singer, mm-hmm. it takes a long time to reach your maturity of voice. Mm-hmm. And you just have to be patient. That's what it is. It's patience. Be patient. With yourself and with others.
And with that, I'd like to thank Vern for his time here and everyone too. And we'll listen to this 5 years from now. And I'll wish you all a glass of red wine.
Thank you very much.